Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated May 8, 2015. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article, this week's cover story, The Battle for Better Licensing. North Carolina's system for regulating professionals is ripe for overhaul. This column is by Jason DeBrun. North Carolinians encounter workers in licensed professions every day. Licensed professions cover 55 occupations and nearly 704,000 jobs, more than one out of every five private workers in the state. With entry barriers that can include education, training, and testing, licenses serve as a threshold of competence, a threshold that both protects the health and welfare of the consumers and preserves the integrity of the professions themselves. But records obtained from state officials paint a picture of a system that has very little oversight, minuscule number of disciplinary actions, and failure to conduct its statutory duties. Among the 703,870 licensed individuals across the state in 55 different professions, there were only 3,760 reported disciplinary actions, or one for every 187 licensees. Additionally, a 2014 state audit determined that 37% of the boards did not comply with reporting deadlines prescribed by North Carolina law, and 11% did not comply with board member training requirements. Even when reports are available, some do not include the required information, and others report figures in ways that are very unclear and do not match the prescribed form. In most cases, the only requirements for most of these licensed individuals are to make their annual renewal payment and attend a continuing education course. The apparent ineffectiveness of the state's licensure requirements is now causing some lawmakers to push a legislative agenda that would provide for fewer occupations requiring licensure. After all, the licensure business is getting bigger. Businesses pay about $67 million in fees to these boards every year. Licensing harms employment in the regulated profession and raises prices, says John Sanders with Raleigh's John Locke Foundation, a conservative think tank. Outside of medicine and a few other professions, there is a broad disagreement among states over what jobs actually need state licensing. While North Carolina statutes place individual boards in charge of the licensing requirements and renewal process, many of these boards don't generate sufficient cash flow to do anything other than process renewal paperwork. Inspections are virtually non-existent, and consumers are often regulated to the expensive legal process to address any damage from professional incompetence. Furthermore, North Carolina's lengthy list of subcategories of licensed professions is, in some cases, duplicative, outdated, and inefficient. North Carolina requires licensure for more professions than many other states. Here, for example, there are 154 licensed job categories. Compare that to 49 job categories in South Carolina or 76 job categories in Virginia. Of North Carolina's surrounding states, only Tennessee with 190 has more job categories requiring licensure, according to a Goldwater Institute policy report. Even within the state, boards operate at a disparate levels. The three boards with the largest budgets, medical, nursing, and pharmacy, account for nearly one-third of all licensing board spending. On the other end of the spectrum, 17 licensing boards operate on annual budgets of less than $100,000. The board that regulates practicing pastoral counselors, for example, totaled expenses of just $5,829 in 2014. Small budgets have put constraints on some boards. Consider the board that regulates opticians. It recorded an operating loss of at least $49,000 every year between 2009 and 2013. Even last year, after cost-cutting measures, it operated at a loss of nearly $20,000. An audit released by State Auditor Beth Wood estimates the board will run through its cash reserves sometime in 2015. Inadequate funding will cause the board to first reduce services, then to stop meeting its statutory duties, Wood's audit notes. Those duties including providing oversight of dispensing opticians. Through Senate Bill 525, filed March 26, the North Carolina State Opticians Board asked the state to allow it to raise fees, but no action has been taken on the bill since March 30. To be sure, some boards provide rigorous oversight. The State Medical Board, for example, requires an annual report of each doctor and has reporting mechanisms to track malpractice settlements and arrests to track North Carolina physicians in real time. The board took 195 disciplinary actions last year and revoked or suspended 35 licenses. Other boards are active overseers as well, but those aren't the boards targeted by lawmakers. In 2013, Governor Pat McCrory proposed the North Carolina Government Efficiency and Reform, NCGEAR, program to develop a strategic transformation plan for state government. This group, quote, proposes immediate elimination of occupational licensing requirements that do not provide value to North Carolina citizens. Eliminated licenses would include opticians, locksmith, natural hair stylists, a.k.a. hair braiders, landscape contractors, soil scientists, and others, end quote, according to the committee. The state is in the process of a two-year evaluation of its licensing boards. Serving as a bookend to that process was a 2014 audit that found that boards operate with ineffective oversight from state-level entities. The lack of oversight at the state level increases the risk that boards are not providing adequate services to licensees or to the public, or have financial issues that are not detected, and concludes the audit. A subsequent report from North Carolina General Assembly Program Evaluation Division found similar results. It is quoted by saying, occupational licensing is intended to help ensure the public that is protected from severe physical or economic harm resulting from the associated activities of an occupation, wrote the report's authors. Despite these concerns, the division recommended against transferring the regulatory authority to a central state agency. Although a central agency might run more efficiently, from a fiscal perspective, the division noted that independent boards are more likely to provide better oversight over licensees. This consideration factored into NCGEAR's recommendation to simply eliminate smaller boards but leave larger boards intact as constructed. In North Carolina, the governor, along with the House and Senate members, appoint most of the licensing boards. Looking at the effectiveness of licensing boards raises the question of whether they should exist at all. Are consumers better served in states that license that service than those without? Conservative groups tend to argue for fewer licensing regulations, but part of the challenge in deciding whether to relax regulations is that professions vary so widely in the potential harm to consumers for negligent practice. Often these regulations make sense. You want your surgeon to be proficient with a scalpel, says Chris Jackson, a research assistant with Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation. But these licensing requirements can be patently ridiculous. Is anyone really convinced that public health or safety is at risk when unlicensed auctioneers, yogis, or tour guides are allowed to practice? In addition, regulations can stifle entrepreneurs, especially for low-income operations. Using data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Department of Labor, the Institute for Justice looked at 102 low- and middle-income occupations and found they require, on average, $209 in fees, one exam, and about 9 months of education and training. The Institute determined that barriers imposed by licensing boards are not only widespread, but are often severe, arbitrary, and irrational. These requirements can be substantial barriers for those seeking work, particularly those who most likely aspire to these occupations, minorities, those of lesser means, and those with less education. North Carolina requires licensure for 48 of the 102 occupations listed in the report and was ranked as having the 29th most burdensome licensing laws and was the 21st most extensively and onerously licensed state. These are organizations that keep the supply of labor in a certain field low, therefore capturing higher prices for themselves, says Sanders of John Locke. That's, of course, great for them, but come at a cost for those who buy their services. For their part, boards want to remain independent and say they provide a necessary public good. In recent months, the drumbeat to combine some of these boards is getting louder, but some fear consolidation may create its own set of problems. Bill Croft, executive director of the North Carolina Respiratory Care Board, says respiratory care practitioners would fall through the cracks if they were to combine with the medical or nursing board. "We are very different than nursing," he says. Thomas Mansfield, the North Carolina Medical Board's chief legal officer, echoes Croft's sentiment. "The medical board has historically opposed taking on other licensees," he says. "On average, the more different things you do, the less well you do each one." Many other boards say the same thing. Furthermore, the boards exist not just for public safety, but also to safeguard resources. The North Carolina Irrigation Contractors Licensing Board, for example, was created in 2009 following a series of devastating droughts. Strict codes and requiring the proper education can reduce water consumption, helping to reduce droughts in the future. One might argue that the Irrigation Board could find a natural home under the board that regulates general contractor or another subcontractor board. Yet irrigation contractors argue that a building contractor has so many other tasks that irrigation issues essential to water conservation and drainage would not receive proper attention. And while continuing education rules may seem burdensome, some licensees don't mind. "We teach the concept that you are a lifelong student," says Dr. Stephen Marks, North Carolina State University Director of Veterinary Medical Services and a certified specialty veterinarian. "The students and veterinarians he knows commit to more than the required 20 hours per year anyway," he says, "so that continuing education is no problem. To become licensed, a veterinarian must earn a bachelor's degree plus 4 more years to become a doctor of veterinary medicine. After that, a small fraction of students, as Marks did, add a 1-year internship and 3-year residency to become a specialist. It's not a job," Marks says, "it's really a labor of love." As an addendum to this article, it should be noted that of the 55 occupational licensing boards, $67 million in fees were paid to these licensing boards. And it should be noted in Jason DeBrun's column that he exposes 703,870 total licensees, and of that number, only 6,501 official complaints were filed. Next up, Amanda Hoyle's column on real estate. Her first column is entitled "Aerial Lift Transit Coming to North Carolina State Fair." Operators of the North Carolina State Fairgrounds in Raleigh want to open a new permanent people mover feature around the most congested areas of the fairgrounds in time for the big annual event next October. The state has proposed building an aerial chairlift or gondola system that would carry people 2x2 to the 4 main corners of the fairgrounds and around the perimeters of the Sam Rand Grandstand and the Midway area for rides and games. The state wants a private owner and operator to lease the ground space needed for the 4 pickup and drop-off stations and commit to a 10-year deal with the state. A request for proposals went out last week, and the deadline for proposals is June 4th. The idea is something that State Agriculture Commissioner Steve Troxler and NC State Fair Management have been wanting to try for years, says Brian Long, who's the spokesman for the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Plus, it'll generate at least some additional revenue for the state fair. Long notes also that the state already has one of these chairlift systems that the department operates during the annual North Carolina Mountain State Fair outside of Asheville each September. Per the state's request, state fair management would like to see the first of four sections open in Raleigh in time for the 2015 North Carolina State Fair that runs from October 15 to 25th. The other three sections would need to be finished in time for the 2016 State Fair. There's no estimates yet on how much it will cost to build, Long says, but all of the expenses would be incurred by the private operator under contract with the state. And Council of State votes to sell Dix Campus. North Carolina's Council of State, in a unanimous vote on May 5th, approved an agreement to sell the 308-acre Dorothea Dix campus near downtown Raleigh, formerly home to the state's largest mental hospital, to the city of Raleigh for $52 million. State Budget Director Lee Roberts noted that terms of the agreement specify that proceeds will be used for mental health. We specified in our budget that the proceeds will be deposited in a mental health trust fund and for the purpose of mental health, Roberts said. Raleigh has until December 31st to obtain financing for the property acquisition. The state moved its last mental health patients out of Dorothea Dix Hospital to the new Central Regional Hospital in Butner in 2012. But the campus is still the base of operations for staff at the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. As part of the agreement with Raleigh, the state will lease about 109 acres for a period of 10 years for parts of the acreage and for up to 25 years for other parts of the acreage for its own use for Department of Health and Human Services usage. Also, construction of a $6 million bridge project serving the 7,200-acre Chatham Park project in Pittsburgh is moving forward without delay after a judge denied a stop work order request by the Chatham Park opposition group Pittsburgh Matters. Pittsburgh Matters has a lawsuit pending against the town of Pittsburgh related to its master plan approval of the 7,200-acre Chatham Park development project in 2014. And the group had in late March requested a motion from the court to stop the construction work of the bridge. It claimed that site plans and final transportation plans for the project had not been approved. Superior Court Judge Elaine O'Neill Bushvan of Durham, however, denied the motion on April 20th for preliminary injunction that would have halted the project. According to a letter dated August 28, the North Carolina Department of Transportation had already approved the driveway and encroachment permits necessary for the bridge project. And Chatham Park developer Tim Smith said DOT had given final approval for the bridge construction plan on September 2. Fred Smith Company is the contractor for the construction. The new Chatham Park Bridge over the North Carolina 64 bypass north of downtown Pittsburgh is being built near where Suttles Road will connect it to the proposed Chatham Parkway and the North Village neighborhoods of Chatham Park. North Village is expected to be the first major phase of residential construction at Chatham Park. And Raleigh restaurateur Lou Moshekos is calling his new Mediterranean-style restaurant Vidrio, which will be opening on the bottom floors of his new three-story restaurant building at 500 Glenwood Avenue. Moshekos is partnering with another local restaurant legend, George Bakatias, to flesh out development of Vidrio's menu design and brand. L&M Restaurants Taverna Agora Greek Restaurant has also closed its 6101 Glenwood Avenue location as it preps for relocation to its new 4,900-square-foot building at 326 Hillsborough Street in the summer. And less than a year after hatching a restaurant in Chapel Hill, the Egg and I is opening a new Triangle location in Cary. The restaurant will be located on Walnut Street near Crossroads Shopping Center and across from REI. It is expected to open in the summer. Moving on now to healthcare by Jason DeBruin. His first column this week is entitled Duke Settles Junk Science Case Claims. Case arose out of researcher Anil Patti's work. Duke University has settled all claims arising from junk science that stemmed from former Duke researcher Anil Patti. This closes a dark chapter in Duke history and one in which the university admitted to serious mistakes. Terms of the settlement were not released, though they are likely considerable given the scope of the lawsuits brought against Duke. In short, Duke University researcher Anil Patti claimed to have found an amazing breakthrough in cancer treatment. The university started a clinical trial in which they tested the treatment on cancer patients. However, Patti's research was later found to be fraudulent, and some of the cancer patients died in the trial. CBS 60 Minutes did a story on the saga. In the original complaint filed in Durham County against Duke, plaintiffs alleged they brought the action because of their participation under false pretenses in a fraudulent clinical trial, exposure to improper and unnecessary chemotherapy, and improper treatment of the plaintiff's cancers based on falsified medical research submitted to the United States government and its entities, various peer-reviewed medical and scientific journals, and to the wider public. Later, attorneys for the plaintiffs cut more directly to the point. Defendants admitted they stood to gain three major things if they found something important. Number one, enhanced reputation. Number two, make money. And number three, obtain more patients, students, and professors from a tag-on effect, according to a motion filed by Thomas Henson, Jr., who represented Walter Jacobs and the estate of Juliet Jacobs, a cancer patient who died after participating in a clinical trial based on the research from Duke. Duke has admitted mistakes. In a January interview, Dr. Robert Califf, the director of the Duke Translational Medicine Institute, who took a leave of absence to become deputy director for the medical products and tobacco at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, reflected on the research that stemmed from Patti's lab. Quote, "I wish I had gotten myself more involved earlier," he said. "There were systems that were not adequate, as we stated. That was a tough one, I think, for the whole institution." End quote. Also, United Healthcare settles non-payment case. Health insurer United Healthcare will spend $11.5 million to resolve decade-old lawsuits brought by the North Carolina Medical Society and three other state medical societies. In 2004, the Medical Society brought a complaint against United alleging, in part, that United would systematically deny payment to NCMS members for medically necessary claims to achieve internal financial targets without regard for individual patient medical needs. Most of the settlement, $9 million, will go toward United Technology upgrades to its provider self-service website, with the objective of increasing efficiencies and reducing delays in claims management and claims resolution. Additional settlement of funds will be allocated to the North Carolina Medical Society Foundation for Physician Education Programming. And hospital safety scores have been released. Rex Healthcare again received an A in the biannual hospital safety score released by the LeapFrog Group. It was the seventh straight A score for Rex, a subsidiary of UNC Healthcare, making it the only hospital in the state to achieve that record. Many groups put out hospital rankings, but the LeapFrog Patient Safety Report is generally regarded as one of the better ones. The group does not require the hospitals apply, nor does it require fees ahead of time, though not all hospitals qualify. In addition, it does not charge a hospital to promote the grades to media, though does charge a fee if a hospital wants to use the rankings in advertisements or marketing. The scores are calculated using 28 measures, which are all publicly available by hospital safety figures. The hospital safety score signifies the overall capacity to keep patients safe from preventable harm. In spring 2015, about 2,500 U.S. general hospitals were assigned scores, with about 30% receiving an A grade. Across North Carolina, 30 hospitals received an A rating, or 39% of the 77 hospitals in the state. That percentage ranks North Carolina ninth in the country, just behind Wisconsin and California. In the Triangle, four hospitals received an A, one received a B, and three received a C. What follows is the list of those scores and their hospitals. The following hospitals received an A: Rex Hospital, Duke Riley Hospital, Duke Regional Hospital, and Duke University Hospital. The following hospitals received a B rating: Johnston Memorial Hospital of Smithfield. And the remaining hospitals received a C rating: University of North Carolina Hospitals, Wake Med Carey Hospital, and Wake Med Raleigh Campus. This week's healthcare, he said it, quote, "Larry, as you know, is the top corporate lawyer in the state of North Carolina, and I'm the guy that pays all the fees," end quote. That was John McConnell of McConnell Golf talking about Larry Robbins of the law firm Wyrick Robbins. The pair were named co-chairmen of the 2015 Rex Hospital Open, hosted at TPC Wakefield, a McConnell Golf property. This year, money raised will go to the Rex Healthcare Foundation for patient assistance programs. Moving on to Lauren Onisorge's column on technology. Her first column is entitled "Wingo: No Dramatics in Management Shuffle." Scott Wingo, who founded Channel Advisor more than a decade ago, has a simple comment when asked about the news announced via security filings May 4th that his chief operating officer, David Spitz, will be taking over the CEO seat soon. "It's time," he says. Wingo says the decision was made 2 weeks before the announcement, at which time Spitz was notified of his promotion. Wingo becomes the executive chairman of the company. "When you're a public company, you get good at keeping secrets," Wingo says, adding that the move involved no internal dramatics of any kind. "It's just a routine management shuffle and one that will allow Wingo more time to strategize the company's future." Wingo says Spitz is real energized with a lot of good ideas for moving the e-commerce company forward. Wingo, along with Carolina Auto Spa entrepreneur Carl Murphy, recently launched another company last year, Spiffy, which he described as the Uber of car washes. With the app, you can summon a car wash wherever you are, something corporations in both the Triangle and Charlotte are already using as an employee perk. Wingo is both a co-founder and investor in the app, which has already launched an aggressive public awareness campaign. While Spiffy has seen early success, snagging corporate customers and creating buzz at entrepreneurship events, Channel Advisor has been sliding on the North Carolina on the New York Stock Exchange. 1 year ago, it was trading for more than double its price at the time of Wingo's announcement. Stock took a dive in January after management predicted an earnings miss, and the numbers have yet to recover. Wingo told investors via earnings call May 4th that the company is still in transition, focusing on larger customers. "It's a move that will mean long-term growth, but it becomes at a short-term cost." Quote, "The nature of this transition means that revenue growth this year will be below our growth rates in the recent years," end quote, he told investors. Quote, "We continue to expect to exit this transition with the ability to generate sustainable and more profitable revenue growth," end quote. And AOL co-founder Steve Case talks North Carolina startups during Raleigh visit. AOL co-founder Steve Case spoke May 5th alongside Governor Pat McCrory to business leaders in Raleigh. Case, who addressed leaders such as Citrix GM of Documents Cloud Jesse Lipson and departing Channel Advisor CEO Scott Wingo, has been to Raleigh before, but this time he says there's a more intense energy. "It's a momentum thing," he says, while standing in front of a giant blue bus in front of the governor's executive mansion downtown during the first leg of his Triangle Rise of the Rest tour. "It feels like there's really a lot of work underway in the last decade to put the foundation in place, but it feels like it could really accelerate in the next decade." He compares the Triangle's entrepreneurship journey to the Internet, starting slow and accelerating as it hits its tipping point. "The diversity of interests here bodes well," he says, pointing to the digital media startups in the Triangle and the opportunity for financial tech startups in the Global Banking Center of Charlotte. "I don't think it's a region that's sort of a one-trick pony. It feels like it's going to be a more diverse mix of entrepreneurs targeting a more diverse sector of the economy. And that works to everyone's advantage, whether they're toiling at the startup or sitting behind a desk at a large corporation. It's the future of the community," he says. "Communities rise and fall based on the success of the economy, and economies rise and fall based on the success of innovation and entrepreneurship." Case's North Carolina investments so far include Mate Energy, Windsor Circle, Automated Insights, and Archive Social. And technology by the numbers. Triangle entrepreneurs are even more optimistic in the second quarter of 2015 than they were in the first, according to the latest installment of the quarterly outlook of Triangle entrepreneurs released by NC State University. 86.7% versus 91.1% in first quarter 2015 report that entrepreneurs anticipate the next 6 months may bring increase in sales. 66.4% versus 59.9% in first quarter 2015 anticipate an increase in capital spending. And 67.9% versus 61.7% in first quarter 2015 anticipate an increase in employment. This week's column on transportation is by Jeff Jeffries, and his first column is entitled, RDU Rethinks Retail Offerings Following Addition of New Flights. Raleigh-Durham International Airport is evaluating its approach to retail in light of its changing flight offerings. Leases for most of the retail outlets in Terminal 2 are set to expire in September. RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin says that has given the airport the opportunity to assess its options. Hamlin says changes may be necessary in light of the new flight to Seattle courtesy of Alaska Airlines, additional flights from Frontier Airlines and Allegiant Air, and the merger between American Airlines and U.S. Airways. Of the 22 stores in Terminal 2, 14 have leases that are up for renewal in September. Leases for the 14 restaurants in Terminal 2 are not up for renewal until 2019, Hamlin says. Hamlin says many of those outlets may have their leases extended following negotiations with RDU, but she says it's possible new stores will open. While most of the T2 leases for retail are set to expire in September, we are currently evaluating this date and our options to determine what we need to do to best meet the needs of our customers once airlines are relocated, Hamlin says. The following leases are up for renewal in September. Three Flows, an automated kiosk offering travel size products. Benefit, an automated kiosk offering cosmetic products. Best Buy Express, an automated kiosk offering electronics. EJE Travel Retail, the terminal's duty-free, duty-paid shop. Hudson Booksellers, a bookstore. Hudson News and Aeromart, a bookstore and souvenir shop. Hudson News and Discover, a bookstore and souvenir shop. Kids Work, a kids' toy store. Life is Good, a clothing store. Shaw News, a magazine and souvenir store. Taxco Sterling, a jewelry store. Tech Showcase Terminal 2, a store offering technology-related items. TravelX Worldwide Money, a currency exchange. And Express Spa, a spa offering massages and beauty products. On the construction scene, in Jeff Jeffries' column on transportation, major I-40 Raleigh exit to shut down. The North Carolina Department of Transportation shut down the ramp for exit 298A on I-40 West near Raleigh on May 8th to allow for a months-long construction project. The exit goes to southbound South Saunders Street, U.S. 70, 401 North Carolina 50. The department says the ramp will be closed so crews can work on the bridge and interchange at that location. There is not a set time for the ramp to be closed, says North Carolina Department of Transportation spokesman Mark Mueller. A lot depends on how long the project takes. While the ramp is blocked off, drivers for both north and southbound South Saunders Street, U.S. 70, 401 NC 50 will be redirected to exit 298B. From there, drivers will either turn right or left at the traffic light at the bottom of the ramp. The project is part of the North Carolina Department of Transportation's $130 million Fortify project, which will involve the removal and replacement of an 11.5-mile stretch of I-40 and I-440 because of severe deterioration. The department says much of the highway substructure in that stretch is crumbling. According to the NCDOT, the initial phase will replace the I-440 roadway between the I-40-440 U.S. 64 split and just north of the U.S. 64-264 Knightdale Bypass. It will be completed in early May. Once complete, I-440 in both directions will be at full capacity, the department says. Granite Construction Incorporated is overseeing the project, and the 4-5 project is expected to be complete by late 2016. By the numbers under transportation, North Carolina is among the states with the most residents wanting to telecommute to work. 8. North Carolina's rank in terms of demand for telecommuting jobs. The state came in behind Pennsylvania and Georgia, but ahead of Colorado and Maryland. 4.3%, the national average of full-time workers who telecommute. 4.5%, the percentage of North Carolina's full-time workforce that works from home. And 5.4%, the percentage of full-time workers in Raleigh who do work from home. And now it's time for A Better World. News and articles from Todd Cohen. Todd Cohen publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. Giving Ex-Prisoners Another Chance is the name of this column. When Drew Dahl managed Just a Clean House, a transitional home in Durham for men getting out of prison, he found that more than half the residents returned to prison, and those who landed under the table work as day laborers had a tough time getting stable employment. And as an accountant for the Durham Economic Resource Center, an agency that provides job training and development for people who face high barriers to employment, he saw that employment agencies typically focus on filling jobs, not on how to get jobs for people who are hard to employ. So he started thinking about how to create an organization designed to employ people where a criminal conviction is what you have to have coming in the door. His solution is Second Helpings, an initiative developed to provide jobs and support services for men and women after they leave prison. Among the estimated 600 to 700 men and women who return to Durham from prison every year, 80% of them lack education credentials and a practical work experience, and after a year, 60% still do not have jobs. Partners in Second Helpings include the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham, a volunteer-based group that provides 12 faith teams that each works one-on-one for at least a year with an individual getting out of prison, and the Durham County Criminal Justice Resource Center, a county agency that provides case managers and support services for former prisoners, plus Core Catering, a company that provides meals for the Religious Coalition's monthly meetings and its biweekly dinners for families of victims of violence, and uses excess food to package and freeze meals that volunteers deliver each week to people in need, including families of victims. Second Helpings needs $25,000 to buy and equip a food trailer and cover its first 2 to 3 months of operating cost. As one of 5 semifinalists in a competition sponsored by Triangle Community Foundation that attracted more than 50 collaborative proposals to address community needs, Second Helpings was awarded $7,000. The goal, Dahl says, is to provide jobs, training, and support to prepare former prisoners for permanent employment. Each person Second Helpings employs will be less than likely to return to prison. We'll save the state the $30,000 annual cost of maintaining one person in prison, and will add to the pool of prospective employees for local food service jobs, says Dahl. He's quoted as saying businesses in food services and hospitality tend to have high employee turnover, largely because many of the people they hire don't know how to keep a job. Marcia Owen, executive director of the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham, says the key to the collaborative effort will be linking ex-prisoners with resources and support. Patricia Jenkins, editor, owner of Core Catering, says Second Helpings can be a launching pad for people re-entering the workforce, giving them the opportunity to maintain a stable position in a company that then can lead them to other opportunities. Also in nonprofit news, this year's Ronald McDonald House of Durham Winterfest Gala, Dr. John Folletta was awarded the inaugural Heart of Gold Award for his groundbreaking work in children's health and his impact on the local and global Ronald McDonald House organizations. Folletta was one of the founding members of the Ronald McDonald House of Durham, which celebrates its 35th anniversary this year. And Wake County snags $100,000 Duke Energy grant. Wake County received a $100,000 grant to continue its commitment to protecting and enhancing regional waterways and the environment. The grant is part of the Water Resources Fund, a $10 million commitment from Duke Energy. The grant will support construction of the Robertson Mill Pond Preserve, the county's only blackwater swamp and bald cypress habitat. And finally, two men in a truck collected used clothing for donation to Interact of Wake County and the Durham Rescue Mission to celebrate Mother's Day. Brooke Wilson is quoted as saying, "Movers for Moms is our way to show appreciation for the efforts of area mothers who may be facing challenging circumstances." She's a franchise co-owner of Two Men and a Truck in the Triangle. This week's column on Executive Force is entitled, "How I Turned My 401k into a Company That Helps Consumers Quit Cable." Lauren Onisorge investigates after a pink slip and a new degree how Mohu CEO jumps into the cord-cutting movement. If you ask inventor and admitted tinkerer Mark Buff, he'll tell you his fate was decided by a pink slip and a 401k fund. His Raleigh company, Greenwave Scientific, operates under the name of its consumer brand, Mohu, connecting consumers to their favorite television programs, no cable cord required. He's prepping a mystery music technology that he can't talk about yet and promises even more innovation. As a young college graduate, he took the road more often traveled, a stable job at then-growing French telecom Alcatel-Lucent, where he settled into Raleigh to raise his family. But that pink slip 7 years later changed everything. "It's such a shock," he says. "You come in, you see this envelope on your desk, and you don't expect it at all." Buff had choices. He could get another job. After all, in the Research Triangle Park in the early 2000s, tech jobs were available. Opportunities were looming at RTP giants such as IBM, Cisco, and NetApp. But Buff didn't even apply. He went back to NC State University. He committed to racking up student debt and, with three kids at home, went all in for a master's degree in computer engineering. A course in radio frequency design is what really changed things, inspiring him to pursue his doctorate and spin out his own company. "I was using my 401k along with stipends from North Carolina State to pay my mortgage," he says. "We were as broke as convicts." Living off adrenaline more than cash, there was a point where he had $50,000 on personal credit cards, but the research was exciting, funded by the Department of Defense, exploring the way wires on a battlefield work. Engineering wasn't a huge leap. He had always been a tinkerer, messing around with Radio Shack electronic kits in his parents' Valdez home. In the third grade, he hooked up piping to his neighbor's pool, filing his first patent for a device that allows you to breathe underwater. When the patent was rejected, he kept tinkering. In college, he hooked up speakers to cars competitively, and at one time he had 42 speakers in his Ford Probe. His next patent, decades later, was in advanced engineering technology. It was initially intended to protect soldiers on the battlefield, research born at NC State while he was racking up the debt. While Buff won't reveal the exact applications, he did spin his research into a company, Greenwave Scientific, which eventually landed enough federal contracts to lessen the debt panic. "It was enough to make him call that Alcatel layoff the best thing that ever happened to me." Years into the company, someone saw a television segment about cord cutting, what people call it when they say goodbye to cable bills, and something clicked. Buff and his team were already working on a distributed antenna system for ground vehicles. Basically, it was a covert antenna system so that instead of carrying a giant and obvious rack, Jeeps on the battlefield could hide their technology below the roofline. The team decided to take a bet that consumers, too, might want a flat, flexible antenna. So Buff bought every antenna available on the market, comparing it to what they were working on, and "ours was so much better," he says. And the Leaf was born. A prototype was built with independent research and development funds, part of the Department of Defense grant. Buff personally put it up for sale on Amazon in 2011, working nights and weekends to ready the stock. After a lot of experimentation, he said, "we had no idea what we were doing on Amazon," Buff had to stop selling antennas because the demand was outpacing what he could create at his North Raleigh facility. Today, flat antennas are manufactured at his facility off Capitol Boulevard, while curve antennas are made in Asia. There are other additions to the lineup, including channels, which allows the customer to access all programming from antenna television to Netflix. Mohu is the entire company now, with defense contracting having been abandoned. Deals such as those with Best Buy and Walmart have solidified the products. To put that into perspective, Mohu has one product at Walmart. If another lower-priced product gets added to the lineup, it could add 50% to our revenue, he says, calling big-box retail deals critical. The firm expects to sell 1 million antennas this year. It doesn't release revenue figures. So far, he's bootstrapped, but he says he's frequently approached by venture capitalists interested in equity stakes. But a new mystery product might tempt him into seeking out growth capital down the line, he says, though he offers few details. We've got another product in the pipeline that could take us to new heights, he said. It's right in line with cord cutting. There's nothing like it on the market, and depending on how much development resources that requires, that will determine if we need to go get outside capital. There's no master exit plan, he says, just values, such as dreaming big and getting things done. But his eyes are always open. You have to have an optimistic mindset 100% of the time in order to be successful, he says. This week's column of Family Business is by Jim Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. His column this week is entitled, Sometimes It's Hard for Relatives to See the Obvious. I'm a strong advocate for family business continuity, but I have to admit that sometimes succession isn't in everyone's interest. That conclusion is hard to avoid in the case of my friend Mark, whose vision of the family business blinds him to some hard realities. For years, Mark has expected his only son, Tommy, to be the next president of the family's electrical contracting business. Tommy was a bright, honest, loving kid, but he told his father repeatedly that he really wanted to join the Foreign Service. He even took the entrance exam when he graduated from college. But Mark kept the pressure on and kept upping the incentives. He finally made Tommy an offer he couldn't refuse and included a fat salary, bonuses only vaguely related to performance, and perks aplenty. When Tommy started with the company as a senior VP, Mark announced that the next president was now on board. As several key employees have told me, it was clear from the start that Tommy and the electrical contracting business weren't exactly a match made in heaven. He's a nice enough guy, said our one crew foreman, but he doesn't understand the basic principles of the business, and I don't think his heart's in it either. Mark insisted, however, that Tommy was born for the job and that his skills and management sense would sharpen with time and experience. When he asked me, I agreed that time and experience can do wonders for a young family member rising in the business, but that a structured program of training and apprenticeship might be necessary too. Oh, he's got all the education he needs, Mark answered. He just has to learn how to run the business. He'll be fine. That argument proved to be so persuasive that Tommy himself began to believe it. His early hesitancy to make management decisions disappeared, and his executive's self-assurance soon exceeded his executive ability. Monday morning staff meetings featured Tommy snapping off commands that brought a smile of pride to Mark's face and shock to the faces of the employees. What does the company's family advisory board think about Tommy becoming the next president? I asked Mark's wife. They're not happy about it, she replied. Most of them think Tommy doesn't know much about the business and doesn't care. They're afraid that when Mark retires, the company will fall apart. But Mark believes what he wants to believe. She shook her head. I wish he'd sell the company before the family falls apart. Mark, I said one day over coffee at the Carolina Moon Cafe, I have to tell you something you probably don't want to hear. Some informed people think Tommy isn't looking so good as the next head of the company. I won't name my sources, but I hear it so often that I have to give it some weight. Tommy's making progress, Mark said emphatically, and he'll do fine. He came to me last week wondering if he should stay with the business. But after I gave him another 15% raise, he agreed to hang in there. I've always wanted this company to be my legacy to my family, and Tommy will make that happen. Sometimes we want something so much, Mark, that we begin to believe it's happening when it isn't. Tommy agreed to do what you wanted him to do, and now both of you are paying for it. Tommy is turning into a person that I don't think he wants to be. You're getting all the loyalty you're willing to buy, and you're putting the family business futures at risk. It's not too late to straighten things out. He stared at me long and hard, and I began to wonder if I'd just lost a friend. And then he said, look, I appreciate that, and I know that you and the others think that Tommy's some kind of self-centered loser and that I can't see it. But I want this business of mine to go on. I want to be remembered as the man who built a successful company that'll take care of his family for generations. Mark stood up and dropped his coffee money on the table. That's my life's dream, he said, and Tommy is my only hope of seeing it come true. As he walked out onto the street, I silently wished him and the company, and Tommy too, the very best of luck. This week's column 9 to 5 features triangle small businesses that grow and are adding to the client base. Bland Landscaping of Apex is preparing to move into its newly constructed facility in East Durham, where it plans to hire 100 to 120 people over the next 5 years. The 4.7-acre site is at 126 Stone Park Court, comprised of two facilities, a 5,600-square-foot building to be used as Bland's operations site for crews in Durham and Research Triangle Park, and a 5,400-square-foot building that will be leased to other tenants. The company cites the City of Durham's recent $4.5 million streetscape project in East Durham as one of the incentives for expansion. We considered an investment here in 2008 but got cold feet when the recession hit, said Kurt Bland, president of Bland Landscaping, in a statement. And he says, now that the city has made strong economic investments, we expect this area to really take off and flourish. Bobbitt Design Build of Raleigh is a construction contractor for this new facility. And the Falls of Neuse office of Raleigh-based Coldwell banker Howard Perry and Walston has been named the top office in Coldwell Banker's southern region, measured by adjusted gross commission income for Coldwell Banker offices with more than 100 sales associates and representatives. Located in North Raleigh at 5,000 Falls of the Neuse Road, the office was Coldwell Banker's Howard Perry and Walston's original site when it was founded more than 40 years ago. And Weedman, with franchises in Raleigh and Cary, has been named the official lawn care provider of the Durham Bulls. As a lawn care company, Weedman and our team members are all very committed to giving people lawns that make them want to spend time outside, says Paul Brooks, vice president of Greenscape, owner of the Raleigh, Cary, and Wilmington Weedman franchises. In addition to promoting team sports and exercise, the Durham Bulls draw people in to support their local team. It builds a sense of community and encourages individuals to enjoy spending time outside. Both goals align well with our focus. The agreement with the Durham Bulls runs through the years 2020. And Smithmore Leatherwood partner Patricia Marcus has been elected to serve a 3-year term on the board of directors of the American Health Lawyers Association beginning in July. With more than 12,500 attorney members, the organization encourages health law excellence through education and information exchange. This week's editor's notebook is by Sukheta Mukherjee, who is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal, and his column is entitled Get Citizens to Pay and Share the Dick's Vision. There were a lot of smiles across the City of Oaks on May 5 when the North Carolina Council of State voted unanimously to approve a $52 million deal with the City of Raleigh for the Dorothea Dix land near downtown. The deal was far from easy, as various stakeholders jostled for a favorable position after an original deal 2 years ago between Raleigh and former Governor Bev Perdue was scrapped by the incoming legislature. It is hard to imagine the amount of time Raleigh City Attorney Tom McCormick and his counterpart representing the state spent to consummate the deal. Now that the deal is done, the question is how we pay for it. Raleigh doesn't have this kind of cash to simply write a check. It has to raise the money. One way would be to float bonds, a move that has appeared to be approved by voters in November. After the sale comes the development of the park that would cost additional millions. Where will all that money come from? The Dix Park Visionaries, the booster group that favored the Dix land sale, has already raised close to $4 million in the past couple of years that could be put to use in the beginning. But that clearly is not enough, and that's where we all come in. Raleigh is a growing city. The U.S. Census Bureau estimates the city's population was 431,746 in 2013, almost up 7% since 2010. It has about 162,000 households with a median household income of $54,000. The city is also home to 64,000-plus people living below the poverty level. As the next step, city officials now need to bring in as many people as they can on the discussion of how to pay for it. Let's not go to the Goodnights and Goodmans again to help us find a financial solution. The families do enough for the area, and they will continue to do more and play a pivotal role towards making Raleigh a world-class city. We need to engage more people to have skin in the game. For example, almost 14% of the city's population is foreign-born. Almost 18% of Raleigh's population speaks a language other than English at home. We need diversity of participation in the form of ideas, contribution, and collaboration. We have a choice in front of us, no question. Public financing plays a primary role to finance a deal this size. We need to do this together, and we, the citizens, should be paying for the development of this beautiful land. But first, city officials need to reach out and make the ask. I hope Raleigh answers the call. Holly Springs welcomes its hometown baseball team. The Triangle's newest Coastal Plain League baseball team, the Holly Springs Salamanders, kicks off its inaugural season May 28th at its new 2,000-seat facility at the North Main Athletic Complex in Holly Springs. The new complex also has tennis courts and lighted synthetic turf soccer fields. The stadium will be also used for town parks and recreational programs, concerts, and other special events. Excitement prevails in Holly Springs, says Holly Springs Mayor Dick Sears. What I hear from citizens is that they can't wait for the Salamanders to play ball. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at www.triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.